Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Well, hello and welcome to this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Horowitz here. We're on episode number 242, and I want to wish you a wonderful holiday season. It's off and running from Thanksgiving already to the end of the year, and we are now looking at November is gone. December is here, actually right in the middle of December, and we finally have some, a little bit of clarification on what's going on in Europe. We're going to spend some time today talking about some year-end strategies. We're going to talk about how, in fact, maybe you can look at your portfolio in a different way. Go over some of the things that happened throughout the year and maybe some of the things that we could learn from it. Talk about some breakouts, the situation that's happening and building in China and Russia, as well as some of the news headlines that we really need to take a look at for next week coming up. You know, we're not going to have a guest this particular episode. We have, you know, kind of the end of the year, I'd like to do a little bit of a recap and refresh. Kind of, we talked with a lot of people and got a lot of opinions throughout the year. Many of them were spot on when it came to Europe, starting with Das. And we've talked with a variety of people in and out of the industry, economists and analysts. We talked about which direction the markets will be in, small caps, large caps. But I thought what we'd do is spend a little time and just talk about kind of where we are right now and what we can maybe expect moving forward. Let's all agree that it's been a really, really difficult year. If it's not been one thing, it's been another. Whether it's a natural disaster, whether it is a man-made financial catastrophe, whether it is what's happening in Russia, potential protests against the government, whatever it's happening here, protests against Wall Street, there's a never-ending stream of data that's coming out, and it's this constant battle to find something to hold on to that looks like, well, it's about over and maybe we're over the top and we're going to move on to the next stage of this either recovery or contraction. And now we have a lot happening with regard to what's going on in the Asian markets and the emerging markets where they're trying to slow down the inflation that has been really plaguing them for a while. India is really looking just awful. And China, of course, has been just ever so slightly loosening up on their tightening stance. But at the same time, if you take a look at what's going on in Asia with imports and exports, and you take a look at their stock market, you look at the overall property values, it's just very disconcerting. And then you add into it, of course, what's happening with Europe. The funny thing at the end of the day is that there is a big, gigantic bright spot in the middle of all this, and it may not seem like it from our position, but it's the United States. In fact, while we have subpar growth here, our companies are still doing very well, generally speaking, and the markets are holding up, and I'm going to give you some examples in a second about that. And we're seeing that at least there's not terrible, you know, misery and warnings from many of the analysts. That may be good or bad. And on top of that, we have an extremely, just a remarkably easy Fed right now. Very loose policy, not considering doing anything that's going to be otherwise. And when you look at that and you compare it to other areas around the world, even Europe, who last week moved their federal rate, you know, the rate of interest they charged to the ECB down by a quarter point, they're still much higher than we are. And around the world, we're seeing that interest rates are really moving much to the opposite side. As a matter of fact, you could think about this as much as we are putting the pedal to the metal when it comes to the Fed, it's really spiking up inflationary concerns around the world. Now, the good news is that some of that has subsided. If you noticed, if I don't know if you've noticed or not, but take a look at the gasoline prices lately. You know, we have oil approaching $100. And of course, we know that while gasoline prices are not necessarily tied to, they are usually correlated with the oil prices. Gas and oil go together. And we've seen somewhere in the neighborhood about $3.20 on average that we've moved down to from about close to $4 during the year. That's a big savings. And that's why retail has been holding up. That's why the consumer is consuming. That's why last week's consumer confidence number looked a little bit better. So let's take a look at markets for a second. We're going to look at the end product and maybe move backwards. And then we're going to talk about some of the internals, about what's happening with what we need to look at in terms of maybe technicals, fundamentals, et cetera, when it comes to markets, and some ideas to hopefully either make money or stay away from the pain. So let's start, take a look with year-to-date. The Dow Jones is up ever so slightly. You look at actually, it's about 4 or 5%. The S&P is down. The NASDAQ is down. You look at Canada is down 10%. Brazil is down 15%. Overall, the Euro Stock Index down 16%. The German market is down 13%. Now, they were down at probably about 8% or more. And the last couple of weeks, they really pulled back tremendously, or pulled up tremendously. You're seeing that in Italy, they're down 23%. Now, the Nikkei, the Japanese market, is down 16. Hang Seng down 19. Australia is down 11. And then we get into the whole China region, or the Asia, really hardcore Asia. But China, you look at the CSI 300 is down 19. You look at the Shenzhen down 25. You look at Taiwan's down 23. You see the little similarities here, right? Asia's just getting creamed. They're getting really botched by sellers. And when you look at why that is, it's, well, in a sense that there is a concern that the tightening is going to continue. I find it really interesting that the strength of the markets right now are so tied to the idea that stimulus will be on or off. In fact, when you start really trying to focus in on the whole idea of stimulus, I want you to start reading articles, whether it's from the Bloomberg or New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, wherever it is. Focus in on the conversation about how economics in a certain area, whether it's, I don't know, it could be in Europe or United States or any emerging market, wherever it is, and look when they give you an economic number, retail sales or durable goods orders, whatever it may be. Take a look about when they come in really pretty negative. They're a surprise to the negative side. What they talk about in the article, oftentimes it's about, well, this is just more ammunition for the Fed of blank, blank country to come in with further stimulus and stimulating types of instruments. Now, that's interesting because is that this the whole economy moving forward is all going to be wrapped around stimulus? We know that there's a limit to how much stimulus can actually be provided, you know, aside from the unlimited money printing that goes on, because you get into trouble. Look what happened with Greece and Italy and Spain and Portugal and all the things that are going on around the world with record deficits and the trouble that it's bringing on these countries. So now we know what's happening here, and I find it really fascinating how much pain is being felt in Asia. When you look at the daily and weekly movements of markets, they kind of get the news first when it happens overnight. Then it trickles down into Europe and that region. Then it comes to us. And by the end of the day, oftentimes the bottom feeders, the value investors, the buy and the dip fellas and girls out there, they're buying up opportunity, they say. And then we kind of go through that rotation all over again. It's kind of like we're putting out our garbage in the middle of the night and then picking up the good stuff in the morning. And I'll tell you something. When you look at that and you look at the returns of the markets, you have to wonder whether or not the U.S. and the U.S. stocks are terribly overvalued or, for example, Asia is terribly undervalued. That makes sense? Because we're finding that there's such a disparity in the two right now that it's almost a conundrum. Because if you see a rally over there, you'll see a rally over here. That's how it usually works. And you see the opposite happen. But this breaking off of the relationship recently has been very, I think, revealing. Who's smarter? I don't know. Are the Asian markets smarter and they're saying, hey, you know what? We see what's going on. We're not involved. Or is it us that say, hey, you know what? This is a great deal. Truth be told, that there is a lot of very positive numbers that have come out from U.S.-based companies. In fact, this weekend, the Chinese Sovereign Wealth Fund came out with a statement. They talked about where they thought opportunity was, and there's, you know, tons of money in the Chinese Sovereign Wealth Fund. This one says they're 60% invested in the U.S., mostly in equities. I thought that was really interesting. Wow. The Chinese Sovereign Wealth Fund, which has opportunity to invest anywhere around the world in any instrument, really, has picked the U.S. equities as their, you know, favorite position. Now, China also, let me just kind of finish up on the China discussion for a second, came out with some further information over last week with their CPI, the PPI. Very, very big changes when it came to their inflation rate over the last few months, and it really moved down significantly. And at the same time, we're seeing the yuan increase in value on a regular basis. China is trying to stoke domestic demand over the exporting as much as they have. But I don't see how that's going to last forever, because already we're seeing a significant drop. We did a run on the Chinese imports and exports and their volume. Big disparity when it comes to the difference between the volume that they're bringing in on a year-over-year basis and the value. For example, 21% drop in crude oil imports on a year-over-year basis when we're looking at the overall volume, how much they're actually bringing in. Coal down 21%, refined oil down 6%, steel was actually up about 13%, aluminum was about 4%, and then when we look at, that was the exports, excuse me, the imports, so the exports were down significantly, right? Imports, okay, iron and refined oil were up a bit, steel, soybeans were down, crude was flat pretty much. But the import volume when it came to things like copper and copper scrap and aluminum scrap were down significantly. That's very telling that what they're doing is actually working. What they're doing with the desire to try to make sure that they are not going to be having a massive surplus or deficit, depending on how you want to look at it, with the U.S. and the U.S. desire to sell products to China and not only have be buyers of Chinese products, and the rest of the world really relying on the massive development and the incredible population of China, it's kind of working in the favor of right now increasing the imports and really messing with the exports. And the reason also is the value of currencies around the world comparatively. But that can't last forever. That just can't. China can't have that much of a disparity in their exports and imports. It's just not going to work. So we may see some loosening. Right now it looks like the tightening is getting a little bit ahead of themselves right now. But it also, if you look at this, is a bearish and a bullish argument. The bearish argument is that, wow, China's numbers are really falling down, and man, this is a global slowdown, and we really need to be worried. Okay. The bullish discussion is, yeah, but they're, at the same time, the value of what they bought, even though it's down on volume, the value of what they bought is much greater. And that's very good for the rest of the world's economies. So there's kind of two sides to this whole discussion, and it's the same discussion that we have when it comes to earnings for companies. I had a discussion late part of last week with a colleague, and we talked about how there's this whole issue with, the unemployment rate is so high, and we've talked about that here, and this horrible situation in this country, and it's terrible that people are suffering, and yet all these companies are doing well. We know the companies are doing well because they slashed their overall expenses. And one of the basic ways they did that was through the elimination of human capital costs, the elimination of labor costs. Now, when you look at the projections for the S&P 500 moving forward, and this is hot off the press, there's again two sides to this. The earnings per share actual this year, so far, assuming it's all over and in the bag, we had earnings per share in total of $95 for the S&P 500 companies. That's good. Next year, the estimates for 103, then 108, then 121, growth of about 8-9% per year. Now, cash flow per share, dividends, all they're all growing, but I thought the really telling number on this was that the sales per share, the revenue, the amount of money they take in, it's going to go from roughly, let's call it $1,000 per share right now to $1,074, $1,095, and $1,152 all the way out. Now, when you bring that all the way down and you look at how much is actually happening, here's where it starts to get a little fuzzy. Because the sales per share are really not growing very tremendously. You know, you have a 21% growth of the earnings per share over the next 3 years in estimates, but you have a 15% or 14%. Let's take a look at that, make sure I'm right on that number. You have a 15% growth on the numbers when it comes to the sales. Now, if you think about that for a second, that means that if they don't have the revenue growing at the same speed, something else is going on. What is that? Well, they're probably cutting something. And one of the things they're cutting is the long-term debt and the net debt per share. So the cost of carrying the debt load and paying for the debt load, whether it's going to be because it's on the books or they reduced their interest rate payments, is going to be lower. Okay, that's, again, all estimates we're talking about here. And when you look at the overall equation, you have to wonder, well, how is that going to all happen? You know, they're going to cut their debt. Okay, what are they going to do? Are they going to issue more shares maybe? They're going to pay off some of the debt with the cash they have sitting on their books. Okay, that's all good things. But again, at the end of the day, revenues are not keeping pace with the same level of net earnings, meaning that there is not going to be a lot of hiring over the next 2 or 3 years, at least according to analyst estimates. You could kind of read into that because that's where some of the big expenses are. They're also saying that expenses are going to go down from here, that you're not going to see a lot more of the increasing in commodity prices. But at the same time, let's give you the other side. Goldman Sachs comes out with a discussion over the latter part of last week that says, hey, here's the deal. What we see next year is that the S&P is going to end the year at about 1250. That's in 2012. So right on spot where we are right now. And the reason for that is there's going to be a lot of margin compression. Well, okay, we've talked about that, and there's been some compression that's been happening recently, but it hasn't been terrible. And that margin compression, says Goldman Sachs, is going to probably take out somewhere about $7 per share, just in the margin compression, from the S&P earnings. So instead of having a growth from where we are today of about $95 per share to $103, we may be down to $92 next year. Just on margin, just on the differential of the cost. Now, what are they thinking? Well, they think cost of goods are going to be higher. There's also going to be higher competition. You may have, for example, the dollar rising over that period of time. You may have the additional employees that you do put on. You know, it doesn't have to be a tremendous amount, but some. You have a whole host of factors that will go into this whole margin compression, and that is going to really start squeezing the earnings. Now, that makes sense, actually. That really does make sense. So I want you to consider that when you're looking at kind of where you're going to be next year and how your positioning is for the next year moving forward and how your positioning is now into this. Truly, we are seeing a global slowdown, but yet the markets in the U.S. are not reacting. Okay, that's good. I think there's a lot of positive influence being put on us by, you know, we have a presidential election coming up not too long. And usually the seasonality of a presidential election is very positive. Now you got two things going for you. You got the December seasonality, and you have the seasonality for a presidential election. President Obama said this week that by the time the election hits, of course, that's important to say, we're going to see 8% unemployment. You know, we just went from 9.1 or so to 8.6 miraculously. And of course, we do know that by every standard, it was due to the drop in the labor participation rate, meaning less people are on the job looking involved in the workforce at all. They kind of just left, and therefore there's a much lower amount of people to compare, and therefore it makes it look like there's more employed or less unemployed, depending on how you want to look at it. And when you look at what is going to be, I don't think that that's too far off, but at the same time, I mean, if there is going to be that level of unemployment, it would be pretty nice to see if we actually have a lot of job gains, not just a statistical anomaly that's being produced in the BLS. I mean, wouldn't it be nice? I'd like it. I'm sure you would too, you know? So now we have to look at, okay, so we have seasonality of the presidential cycle. We have the seasonality of the end of year. Of course, we have a performance chase where a lot of these dips are being bought and bad news is being discounted. Good news is being bought upon. That's a standard. You have a clear and obvious, you know, almost smack you in the face obvious sector rotation that recently occurred, where you saw the winners that were more of the defensive plays, healthcare, utilities, et cetera, move to the bottom of the pack. And at the same time, you saw things like financials and some of the technology move to the top of the pack. There was a big rotation over the last 4 weeks, gigantic. I mean, when I say rotation, it's like a just draw a circle and they swapped from one area of really doing well to an area that's not doing so well. you know, the top swap with the bottom. And there's a lot of reasons for that. It's not just because of maybe economics or earnings or anything like that, but a lot of times what you'll have is this sector rotation strategy that is used by fund managers where they'll buy the worst performing and sell the best performing just to even out their portfolio. They do that for a lot of reasons. You know, one is some tax reasons. One is, you know, that they want to make sure that they have an even amount of whatever particular target they have. So they may say, well, we want a 4% target in the technology and a 12% target in financial. And if the financial drops off and then drops down, they have to buy more of it. That's simple. So that we did see. At the same time, the markets have been incredibly news-driven, right? Every single breath that comes out of Europe or Asia, the United States, is just acted upon in a panic and a desperate mode that has sent markets. Just, have you seen it? There's these end of day moves on just absolute nonsense. Really, I got to tell you, it's distasteful. The movement that is clearly futures and ETF driven at the 3 p.m., 2:30, 2:45, 3:30 hour is just absolutely brutal. If you're, you know, kind of looking at the shorter term. I mean, longer term, it doesn't matter because it just plays out on a daily or weekly basis. But, you know, this, I guess, maybe it's the algorithmic traders, maybe it's just the day traders, maybe it's, who knows? But the news, this is something that I've had as a pet peeve for the last year or so. The media has been just, I think, reckless. Simply reckless with their reporting. And we're not going to go into that. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. So current market conditions, let's take a look at this. So we have, you know, the earnings we talked about, and we see that there is a bit of a deceleration possibly happening on earnings. Okay, so that may have been taken into account from the high what we saw earlier in the year to where we are now. We see that China is slowing and the economy around the world is slowing. You have austerity measures, which, again, I don't understand how austerity and growth mix, but that's happening in Europe. And you're also having, at the same time, a very small amount of volume on the up days and good volume on the down days. And that's not necessarily a good mixture. What happens there is, what the market is telling you there is that market participants are limited. It's really not necessarily the institutional, we'll call it, the hedge funds and the money managers from mutual funds. And they're not the ones that are really moving the market. If they were, especially on the up days, we'd see a lot more conviction in the buying. So that's important. But at the same time, you're also seeing a few breakouts of individual stocks on incredible volume, blowing the tops off to all-time new highs, like a company called SolarWinds, symbol SWI, which we own. Hansen actually broke out, the Hansen Natural. They make the drinks, the energy drinks. They broke out, but not on great volume. But they kind of been slowly but surely creeping higher. Take a look at a chart on HANS. Again, we own that. And one is Questor Pharmaceuticals and QCOR. Now, this one is really interesting. Came into one of our screens, our main screen that we look at about 2 weeks ago or so. And the stock was, it could have been a little bit longer than that, actually. But the stock looked like it went almost vertical over a 3 week period. Earnings were good. Outlook was good. And then it started to consolidate. So imagine this direct, or maybe a 25%, 25 degree move from bottom left to top right. Pretty steep. And when you look at that, you say, well, I'm not going to buy that. It's overbought. It's all this stuff that goes on. But you know what? Our technicals said, wow, this is looking pretty good. But we waited to buy, and we bought it. And it bounced around for a few days. And then we saw that it was starting to press against a very soft ceiling. And what do I mean by that? Well, it was approaching all-time high territory where it bounced off about two or three times. But there was also some support down below. We looked at the support lines. And if you just kind of like glance at a daily or weekly chart, you'll see those support lines. On the top right of the chart, you'll see that there was a clear area that it was bouncing on. And it did that a few times, even in the tough days of the markets. And then all of a sudden, when the markets kind of started moving the end of the week and the middle of the week last week, we saw a little bit of life being popped in on some better volume. And as soon as it pivoted off of a very key support level, this is important, the pivot from a support level. We've talked about support before. We talked about, you know, watching for downside risk or looking for upside on either the support or resistance levels. But the pivot is kind of one of the important tells where you see it bounce, right? Sometimes it's called a bounce. But it pivoted from moving down to a support level, and then it just moved right up from there, meaning there was really not much more selling that was going on at that point, and buyers were very interested. And then it just vaulted through the top where there wasn't much volume played before because it was an all-time high. But once that happened, you know, clearly the short sellers threw in their towel and said enough. Volume picked up by about 250% or 220% on Friday, and the stock moved up like 7% to an all-time high. And that's really telling in a market that has been so indecisive, where you see a winner, you know, an Apple, doing great, and then just tailing off. And then it comes back a bit, and then it tails off. And it kind of goes through this routine for a while. Now, that's the same kind of situation. You got to see if Apple has that. Now, Apple is on our overall list. It scores a little bit lower, so we don't own it right now. We've been in and out of it. But it does look very healthy, like there is an opportunity, kind of, if it can get past this, I guess, the level it is right now. If you look at the chart of Apple, and you take a look at the kind of, the current cycle of highs and lows and midlines, you'll notice that it's pretty regular. It's just, you know, kind of bouncing and consolidating back and forth. So there is a threshold bottom, if you will, and there's also a threshold top. And it's getting towards the top end of that entire consolidation pattern. And that's something that is, I think, interesting to look at. But the main thing is that also we're finding, even though we're talking about all this, that there is a lack of conviction on markets. And the correlation with markets and equities has been very, very high lately, meaning that there's a lot of futures and ETF-driven trades going on. In fact, if you notice, the S&P 500 has been moving right up against its declining 200-day moving average. There's a very important line for institutional investors. It's declining 200-day moving average, where, again, you want to see kind of more of an uptrend in the best-case scenario of both the 50 and the 200, and the 50 is usually above the 200, and this time it's not, actually. So that means the longer-term trend is down, and you're seeing the declining or the sloping down of the 200-day moving average. Now, when you see that and you start seeing that the index gets up to it and then pauses and gets up to it and pauses, you're seeing that the declining level of the 200-day moving average is kind of hold. In other words, it will continue moving lower if it can't really get significantly, the shares price can't get significantly higher. So what do you do with that? You have to put up a little bit of a cautionary flag, and you have to say, okay, I get that right now we are in a general uptrend, short-term uptrend for the markets. Okay, that's good. I understand that some of the seasonality is also very good. So that leaves me with, well, what can derail this? And there's a lot of things. I think that obviously the reality that the plan that they laid out in Europe last week was not at all sufficient. That will come back to bite them, I believe. The IMF has already said that, you know, that is just not going to do it. They came out this weekend and said, you know, that's great that you did that, but that's not the whole deal. That's not going to cover everything that needs to be covered. Everybody knows that. Kind of don't want to hear it. We'd like the stocks to go up. We'd like to see the bonds settle down a little bit in Europe so that they can actually put off some decent auctions, possibly, and also at the same time get some cash in their coffers so that they can actually run their countries correctly. So we're seeing that not only is the S&P 500 battling its 200-day moving average, but also seeing the small cap index, like the Russell 2000 or the S&P 600, that is also hitting resistance. Now, I'll share this with you. If you take a look at a chart of the Russell 2000, this is the small cap index. And I'd rather you look at the index rather than, for example, IWM, which is the small cap Russell ETF, because they correlate and their pricing is about the same in terms of the movement. But yet at the same time, when you want to look at what the index is doing, I prefer you just look at the index. So now what's happening here is that the index is really just right up against a really important resistance level. Now, let me take you through this for a second. And these are really important numbers to think about. So right now, the Russell 2000 closing on Friday was about 745.5. Call it 745. And that number is a very important resistance level, right up to about 747. So 745 to about 747, 748 is this very, very tight, hard-coded resistance level. Take a look at the chart. You'll see it. Just draw a line right across the top there, and you'll notice what I'm talking about. There's also some very important volume characteristics where that's trading. The big volume that has traded at that level has really been seen coming both on the buy and the sell side. So there's a battleground right there, not only from a price level, but also from a volume. So you have both things that are really coming into play here. You want to find out where the players are really focusing in. And you can do that on price, but you could also do it on volume. Okay, so now the question we have to ask is, where's the blow-off point? Where's that point where you're just going to, if there is such a thing, you're going to find this gigantic level of resistance that all of a sudden, when you break it, it's going to be like a bottle rocket just taking off. It's going to be just this incredible surge because you're going to have shorts covering. Corey Rosenblum calls it pop stops. You're going to have all these automatic stops covering. And then from there, you just go to a next level because there's really no resistance. Wouldn't that be great? Okay, that's like what happened with Questcore we talked about a second ago. So now you have this 747 number, and then you have one last threshold, about 751, approximately 751. Once you get past 751, there's a gaping gap in there that will push the markets on the Russell 2000, let's call it, up to about 780 in no time at all, about a 4% move, dramatic move on the Russell. Why? Because there really hasn't been any time that players have been involved in that market. Therefore, there's really no buy orders laying out. There's no sell orders laying out. You don't have anybody really that has a significant holding there. You can see it. You can see it in the chart. Going back pretty far, there really hasn't been a lot of time or volume spent in that area. And that is usually the way that you see those real big run-ups or run-downs. Think about recently the movement of markets in the summer or just a few weeks ago where you saw that gigantic drop-off, right? Well, what happened afterwards? Big jump. Why? Because once it did get past a threshold level of resistance, let's say, it really moved up dramatically. Now, of course, you can't, you know, one of the problems we have right now is there's so much government intervention that you can't just rely on only technicals or even fundamentals or governments, for that matter, what they say. Because what they say and what they do and what they say and what investors know and what they do are totally different discussions. And when you see these kind of things, what we can say is traditionally, if this happens, then the probability is pretty high that that's going to happen. Again, it doesn't always fit the bill because you have overriding market influences that are really affecting things right now. But let's just pretend, let's pretend for a minute that we're in a normal market condition. Now, in a normal market condition, we may not have these big gaps, but okay, we'll have some. But this one's a big one. So right now, it kind of pays in a way to be short of the Russell 2000 because if we have a partial, an uptrend, you could be in some quality stocks out there. Okay, that's great. And maybe be short the more aggressive area until you get past a level that you're confirmed that, oh, this is going to really rise and be a problem. So that's what we've done. We've actually loaded up on some of our favorite individual stocks and some ETFs from around the world of countries and sectors. And we have a short position on the Russell 2000 to offset it. Now we're a little underwater on that, but we're ahead on the stocks, for example, since we put that on and when we saw that the markets turned. And then also we have a position, for example, in the VIX. We talked about that last week and I think the week before, I believe, but I really focused on it last week. And I hopefully you looked into that. The VIX ended off the week, kind of down 13%. But there was probably about a 30% spike in the VIX before that. So if you got in on it early, you had a nice protection in your portfolio. And now you either have two choices. The choice is that you're going to pick it up again because you believe that there's volatility that will be involved in the markets to the year end. Or you're kind of like, well, you know what? Forget this. I'm going to go either you know, ride this thing bare and kind of take no hedging, or you take a little bit of hedging here with something like the VIX or inverse to the Russell 2000. RWM is a symbol. It's a single inverse to the Russell 2000, and that makes sense to use that instead of, for example, a triple right now or a double, where we're relatively close. We're talking about, what are we talking about? About 1% or so away from a pop area, you know, where we're going to pop those stops. So if it does pop and happens very quickly, whether it's going to be overnight or whether it's going to be during the day, you don't want to be stuck with something that's really going to get just trashed on the short side if that happens. It happens sometimes. You can't help it, the way these markets work, and especially because all the markets around the world are not on the same time zone. That would be a lot more fair and fun, I guess. Or maybe not as much fun. All right, let's see. I talked about retail a little bit. Gasoline prices have come down, and the retail stocks have been very resilient. Have you noticed? I mean, some of them are doing great. And the reason for that, against probably all argument, is that the consumer in the United States is still pretty strong. The consumer around the world buying things in the United States is probably even stronger because the dollar is so weak. And also because we're seeing some let up in commodity costs and the pricing of things. And, you know, we had this gigantic inflation scare in the mid part of the year, and now we're seeing it just slowly but surely move lower. OPEC has also agreed to increase production, but who knows what really is going to come of that. And what we're seeing, that, you know, that extra few cents in your pocket is allowing for consumers to go out and buy. So that's great. So that's good news. So let me give you a couple of reminders and things that I want you to know about. First of all, very important, I think it's important, we have a poll that is on the site, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And that poll, that question that we're asking you, is very simple. And I think you're going to probably have an opinion here. Want to know who, out of the list of, I don't know, 20 guests that we have that we listed, that have come in, where we've gotten a lot of emails back from people saying, hey, that was a great guest. Who is your favorite guest from 2011, from the list we gave you there? And again, these are the kind of the top guests that who have elicited a lot of emails saying, hey, that was great, or comments, et cetera, and, you know, bring backs. So go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll put a link in the show notes for this show. And I want you to tell me, vote if you will, who was your favorite guest on the show this year? We'll try to bring her back or her back as soon as possible. All right. Remind, end of year IRAs, distributions, if you're old enough, RMDs. Year-end mutual fund distributions are going to be coming if they haven't come to you so far. So be aware of that. When you have a mutual fund, capital gains, dividends are going to be either reinvested, but they are going to be passed through by the end of the year. Make sure that you take a look at your portfolio to offset gains and losses if possible. Again, that's why that sector rotation is going on. And you can actually benefit from some of that. So take a few minutes and maybe call your accountant, your financial planner, your advisor, do it yourself, and take a look at offsetting some of the gains with losses, losses with gains, etc., to kind of even out your tax situation. You have to look at what you have carry forward, of course, to make sure that you're taking off the right amount and what it is. So, but those are kind of a few things that you need to do by the year end. And all, of course, it's a great time to take like an inventory of, you know, what do you have that you're hanging on to? Can you actually get rid of this? Am I just holding it out of hope or fear? You know, do I want to kind of start again? It's kind of like the, you know, my favorite time of year is, I talk about this a lot. You know, what about, I don't know, let's see, probably November of any year. If you drive by any of those Bally health clubs or the spas or any kind of, I guess, workout place, I find that the parking lots are kind of empty. But if you go maybe on the 5th of January, there's a whole different look, isn't there? Kind of everybody has that New Year's resolution thing going on. They're going to do so. You know what's great about it? It's great that we do that. Unfortunately, it usually doesn't last very long. But if you can get yourself into that mode with your portfolio and you find things that make sense and things you're not just sitting on because they've been there and they were passed down or whatever the reason is, you know, whatever it is, and be proactive, this is a great time of year to do it. Now, some of the new news headlines you need to take a look at for next week, okay? We have bonds in Europe. What I want you to pay attention to, and we're gonna write this up on the site on a regular basis. We talk about this on thedisciplinedinvestor.com all the time. These things are daily. You could actually sign up for an email subscription. In the top right, there's a little thing that says subscribe, which that's the email subscription. You get a daily compendium of what goes on. That's through one of the Google apps. They send those out to you automatically and nicely formatted so you see what's going on with summaries of the articles that we write, as well as the fact that if you want to follow me on Twitter, we will be actively putting things up there as well. Just that's at Andrew Horowitz, one word. Just follow me on Twitter, and then you can get instant updates. As a matter of fact, what happens is that when we actually write, for example, a story, or we put up a podcast, immediately as soon as we put that up, what happens is that it will go directly to Twitter, so you'll have it before, you know, the email would come from that service, or if you happen to look, or, you know, decide to go midday to an RSS reader. So go check that out and sign up for that too, because I think if you're interested. But we need to look at bonds in Europe, in particular in Italy. If the bond yields get above 7% again, if they do, and what was, I think, very telling about what people felt about the move on Friday was that Italian yields moved up, not down. And Spanish yields moved up. And Portugal yields moved up. But Germany moved down. That's good. France kind of stayed about the same. But the big issue, the big elephant in the room, the big concern that I have and I've been talking about for a while is France. But Italy, above 7%, watch out. If investors start selling off again at this point, the problem is that, in a way, the EU and ECB kind of closed off some options by coming up with this date of December 9th. Because if now there is additional problem, they can't just go back. Already the UK has told everybody to go fly a kite. He's not interested. Cameron said, you know what, we're pulling out. We're not doing this. We're not involved in the EU in this whole deal. It's going to hurt us. It's going to be a problem. The EU wouldn't bend on their financial services terms, their taxes, their austerity that's going to be related to that. And Cameron, who has the hub of finance, hedge funds and money managers in London, said, that's not happening. We're not doing this. So there's been a lot of resistance there, and you have to watch to see what the bond vigilantes are going to do. So Italy, over 7%. The three-month swaps, which were at 165. Remember I told you the get under your desk number and hide was 150? Well, that's right when all of a sudden you saw the Fed come in and five countries come in at the same time and actually come in to rescue, if you will, and offer a drop in their lending rate to countries and banks of Europe. And that drove up markets nicely, and it drove down yields. That was good. That actually moved down the three-month euro-dollar swap as well. Went down to about 110. Well, slowly moved up to 122 again on Friday, and it was creeping up throughout the late part of the weekend. That's important. Pimpo's Bill Gross, he just put a whopping amount into U.S. Treasuries. You know, he was out of it. He missed the whole deal. Now he's back into it. I'm not sure if he's a contrarian indicator at this point, but you know, great bond manager for many, many years, knows when he does wrong and kind of changes, which is always important to do, changing strategy, at least partially. And he believes that there's going to be continued strain in the world, and he opted to put chunks of the portfolio for the total return bond fund into treasuries. Again, you got to watch those too. So you got to watch bonds in Europe, in particular Italy, yield over 7%, and watch the 10-year yield here if it dips under 2%. That's going to be kind of your warning signs, okay? You're going to look at the Fed rate decision that's coming, I think it's Wednesday of this week coming up. And there'll be a meeting afterwards where Bernanke will be speaking and getting things done there. Protests in Russia, that's something you got to take a watch on also. We actually have a small Russian position in our portfolio. Russia is just a really, you know, they're going to be affected by a lot of different things. And obviously the protests are an issue and oil prices and commodities. But boy, if you look at the economy in Russia and you look at the stock valuations and you look at all that, and maybe there's a reason for this, but they look, you know, almost delicious. I mean, the economy seems to be really doing well. And unless something really disastrous happens there, I don't know why there should be a problem except for the fact that you have all these protests. Now, if we know how investors react to these things, we know that, you know, when it drops a bit, they're going to start picking it up just like they did with Japan. You see that upswing, and then there'll be a reality check sometime in the future. But I think that the most interesting thing that has happened last week, the most fascinating and the most, I don't even know the word to describe this, hilarious, disgusting, unbelievable, is that Congress postponed the vote on the insider trading. Have you been following this at all? This is spooky. So let's say that there's a vote going to happen in Congress on healthcare, that they're going to allow or not allow, depending on how the vote goes, home healthcare agencies to operate with federal funding. I'm making this up, okay? And this vote is coming on, let's say, next Tuesday. And they kind of know which direction this is going. And because they're inside, they know what's going on, right? Now, moreover, they know how they're going to vote. They know how their constituents are going to receive it. And they also know how their fellow buddies up in Congress are going to want to vote. And they also know that there's going to be something coming up that's going to be a little bit of an extra ding or a benefit to somebody in there. So they may actually have something in there that really isn't well known. And they go out and they start buying the home healthcare companies on the stock market because they know this is going to really benefit them. Again, I'm making this up. Up until this point, there's been no oversight of this. Can you believe it? I mean, it sounds ridiculous, right? You're saying, what is he talking about? I'm not kidding. There has been no significant oversight or rules involved in Congress going out and basically acting on insider information and then buying stocks and companies that may be under some kind of changed legislation within the legal environment of Congress. I mean, that's just unbelievable. Do you realize that if that happened in the real world outside of government, do you realize hedge would roll? I mean, if we found, I mean, look at what's going on with Goldman and Raj Rajazaman and or however you say his exact name and what happened there and the little leakage of information from here to there and somebody acted on it and they made a profit and oh man, but yet if you're in Congress, you're allowed to actually figure out what's going to be a new law that's being put on the books and then go buy a stock. And then when they decide that they're going to look at voting on making that potentially illegal, they postpone it. Why do they postpone it? There's a lot of reasons, but it's probably so they can get a little more in their pockets by the end of the year or by the time the vote comes up, or maybe hope for the public forgetting about it. And I got to tell you something. That is an outrage. That is probably one of the most despicable, and it is a travesty of trust. How can you trust, if you did, how could you trust a political figure to vote correctly if his wallet is on the line? How can you vote for, or how could you support a political figure who is possibly going to be sharing information with his family or friends about what's going on? It's got to be all interrelated, right? It's interesting, if you think about it, how the markets have reacted prior to a particular legislative action being brought. And maybe that's a tell because Congress has been, you know, spreading the news. I don't know how you feel about it, but I find it to be just absolutely repulsive. You know, it's one thing, the insider trading of companies, and I get that. But, you know, when you have the power to make or break an entire sector or an entire stock market, you know, think about the banking votes that were taken and TARP and how much was actually played by the congressmen who or congresspeople who were in the know that there was going to be this. How about when they decided to take out GM? How about when they decided to take out Fannie and Freddie? I mean, were they short those? Right? Do you ever think of that? Terrible. Anyway, that was kind of an interesting story. I think that's going to have a lot of reverberations coming up. And finally, I'll just mention that when you look at one more stock thing I want to mention to you is when you look at shorting right now, you got to be really careful. It's got to be kind of under the support levels. And oftentimes what you want to do is try to pick up a pair trade. This is kind of a separate topic, something I wrote down and scratched down. I wanted to make sure I mentioned. For example, we have a very small position on Gulfport Energy, GPOR short, against WTI and CLR. WTI and CLR are related in that genre of, we'll call it mid-level oil and gas research / development / distribution, if you will, and in the same general area. But what we're finding is that Gulfport has had a couple of different concerning, I like the company, by the way, I mean, generally speaking, But if I was to pick out of all the three right now, it looks like that Gulfport has a much more, I guess, telling technical indicator. Because when you look at the stock, it's been able to recover, but really not reach the levels it should have, considering the rest of its peers. So I think that when you look at some of these that are going on right now, I mean, you got to be careful, like I said, because even look at what happened with Green Mountain Coffees. A lot of guys came in and said, hey, we're shorting this, we're going against this, and it dropped like a rock, and then whoop, turned around and went, you know, much higher. I mean, on a dime. You know, you look at what happens with a Netflix. Netflix drops, bounces, keeps on dropping. But, yet, you know, it's hard to take a position with that kind of movement. That's why this whole idea of, I mentioned earlier, with big gaps, got to be careful of those big gaps because you can get really burnt. Either way. And we're seeing a lot of that with the manic movement of the markets in and out and this whole risk on, risk off trade. You're seeing these gaps, and the gaps are very detrimental to your health. Remember that. Because if something gets into a gap, whether it's on the upside or downside, and you're on the wrong side of that, watch out. So take a look at those stocks I mentioned. I'll kind of repeat some of the stocks I mentioned right now. I talked about Hansen Natural, HANS, Q-Cor, which is Questor Pharmaceuticals. I mentioned SWI, which is SolarWinds. No, they are not a power company. They are not anything to do with energy. They're actually a technology company that makes networks more efficient. Let's see, what else we mentioned here? We mentioned GPOR, which is G-P-O-R, Gulfport, shorting that against WTI and CLR, or partially of those. Or just maybe if you don't want to short, just go long the other two, or look at that. And of course, it's not a recommendation to buy or sell anything, just some thoughts that you may be interested in. We're going to end it there. We're going to have next week a bit of a year-end wrap and talk about some of the things that we need to do because we're getting towards that time, and also set up for some of the guests that we have coming up in the next few episodes. If you have any guests that you want us to bring on, you know, feel free. Send it over to me. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And if you are thinking about, hey, you know what? Yeah, maybe it's time to do something with my portfolio. You know, it's been a rough year. By the way, don't feel bad. It's been a rough year for pretty much everybody. I've talked to a lot of money managers. I've talked to a lot of people that have been in this business for many, many years, and it's downright frustrating because the movements, the monkeying around, and you wonder if everybody's frustrated, well, who's happy? It seems like everybody has a little bit of frustration here or a lot of frustration, and nobody's exactly happy. I mean, that's what happens when you have these kind of gyrations and you go from the beginning of the year at X and you end the year at X. That's kind of what happens, right? Nobody's right, nobody's wrong, but everybody's frustrated. You know, if you ended the year up 25%, well, at least somebody's happy. Somebody's frustrated. You ended down 25%, same thing. But, you know, right smack in the middle of zeroness, you're not going to have anybody really happy. And maybe that's the better way right now because there really is no reason to be terribly excited with all the things that are going on. A lot of uncertainty. And, you know, the one thing that markets hate more than anything is uncertainty. Well, if you do want to find out more and you want to check out how we run portfolios and all that and some of the things that we have coming up, go over to disciplinedinvestor.com, and there is a 12-minute virtual tour of how we do things. You can check it out and see if that's for you. $50,000 minimum for that, $500,000 minimum for our managed global allocations. We have a variety of different risk levels of that where we rotate and utilize a variety of different techniques to get global exposure, a little bit more of or less of a trading environment than the TDI managed growth strategy. But nonetheless, it's something that, you know, is appropriate for some people. And I'll mention to you just one more time, if you do want to get instant information or relatively instant information, sign up for Twitter and follow Andrew Horowitz. Until then, I'll see you next week. And I look forward to getting your emails. Have a happy and a healthy and a profitable. See you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.